Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. We got to play a bit more of the intro track there from Thomas Dolbit, She Blinded Me With Science. If you tune in regularly, you know we generally start with a little snippet of that. You got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual, of course. We'll be speaking to RPG later in this hour. Normally we have guest speakers. Unfortunately, Gareth's now on summer recess until the autumn, summer break. But all being well, next week, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, our guest speaker will be Chris Dale. I'm not sure exactly what he might be talking about. It could be food, could be allergies. Let's see. This show is all about science in all its different forms. We do cover quite a wide range of stuff. First up, a reminder that the annual UK Big Butterfly Count is ongoing at the minute. It started yesterday. That's Friday the 17th of July, just in case you're listening on catch-up. And it runs until Sunday the 9th of August. So help assess the health of our environment by counting the amount of and type of butterflies and dayfly moths you see in a 15-minute period. Go and check out www.bigbutterflycount.org. There is quite a lot of butterflies around at the minute. I think that's due to the very, very dry weather. Not so good for other wildlife and plants, I'm afraid. So, but never mind. Next up, Paul. Oh, he's scrapping with some technical issue. We'll talk about what else is in the science news this week then. So first up, the COVID inquiry has published its report into why NHS workers did not have enough personal protective equipment, or PPE for short, when the pandemic hit. The scramble to buy PPE during the pandemic saw the UK waste almost £10 billion of taxpayers' money, the inquiry says, with tens of millions of pounds more spent on other equipment that simply could not be used. Next up, the NHS has urged people in their 50s to test for bowel cancer in response to low numbers in that age group taking part in screening. Bowel cancer can develop without any symptoms, but catching it early can save lives. Free home testing kits are sent to all 50 to 74-year-olds every 2 years in England, Wales and Scotland. Testing kits require tiny stool samples, which are checked for blood, helping to detect bowel cancer early. The free kits, which are also known as the Facial Immunochemical Test, or FIT for short, or FIT test, can be posted back in a prepaid envelope. Paulie's back.
I'm back. We've got a few problems. Anyway, Britain is facing a very rare extreme marine heat wave that could be the country's worst on record. Scientists said the exceptional sea temperatures could result in mass die-offs of fish and be contributing to the warm nights on land that are causing widespread sleep deprivation. The warm waters have also been accompanied by an influx of an unusual fish and jellyfish blooms. Ooh, jellyfish.
Ooh, I know. Yeah. Meanwhile, as part of a £57 million government-backed project to cool the planet, British scientists hope to alleviate the effects of climate change by delivering a small jolt of electricity to clouds. Giles Harrison, a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Reading, hopes to increase cloud reflectivity by delivering electric charge from drones. Yeah, drones. Interesting.
And plant growers are already starting to pull out of next year's Chelsea Flower Show in an escalating row about peat-free compost. Ooh. The Royal Horticultural Society, RHS, is banning the majority of peat-grown plants at next year's show over environmental concerns, but growers say they are simply not ready to switch. The RHS has written to the government requesting it follows through on long-held commitments to ban peat compost in law. Wow.
Indeed. Elsewhere in the news, the RSPB, or Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, has bought a 96-hectare area of land in Wales, which it hopes will form a vital missing link between two parts of an existing reserve. The recently acquired Galt Ye Bear area of Carmarthenshire is home to internationally important habitats, including temperate rainforests and peat bogs, and provides crucial habitat for woodland birds such as pied flycatchers.
About 1.6 million drivers seeking compensation for their diesel cars have broadly lost their claim after a court found most vehicles did not contain illegal defeat devices to cheat emissions tests. The High Court rejected allegations that 14 car companies had used prohibited defeat defences in diesel cars, which make emissions look lower in tests than they are in real-world driving.
And finally, did you know that? This is an interesting one. According to latest research, new cars in Europe are growing a centimetre wider every 2 years, a phenomenon that environmentalists have dubbed car spreading. There with Drive, of course, only, well, 42 years ago, 1984, believe it or not. We played that because we were talking about cars, and basically, research says that cars in Europe are growing a centimetre wider every 2 years, which you might not think matters, but actually it does if you're trying to park it somewhere. And indeed, the length of vehicles is getting bigger as well. Interesting. You're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms, every Saturday morning live from 11 until 12. Next up is an absolute brilliant article I saw in the press. It was in the Times, early this year, in February. It was an article about remembering loved ones, as they often do. It's a full-page spread, and it was about a person or professor called Peter Jarrett is a polymath and pioneer of early computers. And I thought it was a fascinating article, which I've saved until now. So, Professor Peter Jarrett was a talented academic who was at the forefront of the development of the field of computer science and the introduction and use of computers in university teaching and industry. A polymath and brilliant thinker, He was inspired by the work of pioneering computer scientists Alan Turing and Tony Brooker, and in the 1960s went on to develop processors to overcome the hardware and memory constraints of early computers. Now, if you're old enough, you'll remember life was a bit different before computers. So alongside his work in applied computer science, operationalizing and improving early computers by 1971, Peter Jarrett was predicting a need to protect data security in computing. Decades ahead of others, he went on to turn his attention to concerns about computer hacking, the use of artificial intelligence and risk management. So he was well ahead of the game, already thinking about that back in 1971. So Peter Jarrett was born in Hull, so not that far away, in 1935 to Edward Jarrett and Edna Nee Pearson, who were both English teachers. He was the elder of two and had a younger sister. When he was eight, the family moved to Bingley in West Yorkshire, where his father took a post teaching English at Bingley Grammar School. Peter Jarrett later joined him at school, where, in addition to excelling in mathematics, his interests ranged from literature to poetry, the classics and music. He was a talented pianist with a love of music that led him to develop an encyclopedic memory of the major compositions. So quite a smart chap. In 1954, Peter went on to read applied mathematics with statistics at Manchester University. It was there where, when not distracted by competing for the university chess team, he came across the early computing work of Alan Turing, who had been working in the Department of Mathematics until his recent untimely death through cyanide poisoning. Who knew, eh? Peter was also inspired by the work of the computer scientist Brooker, who had written a language called Mark I Autocode, which had simplified the programming of the world's first commercially available digital computer, the Ferranti Mark I. Maybe somebody out there might remember that way back. After graduating, Peter Jarrett used his mathematical talents as a programmer in the nascent nuclear power industry of the newly established International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. Yet by 1961, he had returned to academia as a lecturer and then senior lecturer at the Bradford Institute of Technology, which later became the University of Bradford. And he did that while obtaining his PhD in computer science. Remember, this is way, way back. At Bradford, he initially conducted nuclear power-related research regarding the use of computer programming to determine the most efficient distribution of fuel elements in advanced gas-cooled nuclear reactors. They were the second generation of gas-cooled nuclear reactors, of which a prototype was in development at the time, later becoming the backbone of UK's nuclear generation fleet. However, he's a very, very interesting chap, obviously. However, aware that computers could be utterly transformative, if not constrained, as they were in the early 1960s, by hardware and memory limitations, Peter Jarrett then focused his research on mathematical techniques to speed up their processes. He developed the methods for the more efficient use of computers in solving mathematical problems, such as the use of the iterative function for solving equations, the generation of square roots, and the determination of points of inflection, enabling companies to use computers to solve real world problems. Along the way, he developed the Jarrett method, which is a numerical technique for finding roots of non-linear equations that has subsequently been widely considered and applied for its computational efficiency. It was while he was working at Bradford in 1969, so this is how far back it is, he met Jeanette De Beer, with whom he found he shared many interests. Their start of a lifelong partnership, they married shortly afterwards and went on to have a son and daughter. Ever encouraging, he would support Jeanette in all her lengthy community endeavours, which include her roles as a magistrate, the chair of the governors of a Birmingham grammar school and the director of a housing association, which would later be recognised with an MBE in 2016. In 1972, Peter Jarrett became a professor and director of the computing laboratory at the University of Salford, where he valued his interactions with the Chancellor of the University, Prince Philip, And while the prince appeared to show a keen interest in computer progress and the work of the computer science department, it seemed to have been superseded by his desire to visit the set of the TV soap opera Coronation Street, which was next door to the university, followed by an impromptu convivial pint or two in a local hostelry. It was a real gift to Peter, who delighted in regaling entertaining stories to friends and colleagues, and in whom Prince Philip could not have wished for a more enthusiastic tour guide and drinking companion. In 1975, Peter Jarrett became the first professor of computer science and director of the Centre for Computing at the University of Birmingham, becoming Dean of the Faculty in Science in 1985. This is another interesting one as well. By this time, he was also in charge of Television Centre. Peter wished to take advantage of the advances in capability of linking multimedia workstations, cheaper microcomputers and networks, and the deployment of free satellite television transmission from other countries. He devised a use of artificial intelligence by way of an intelligent computer-aided instruction to assist in educational training, as well as implementing distributed computing at the university, whereby interconnected computers work together on a network. At Birmingham, where his contemporaries included the novelist David Lodge, he was known for hosting legendary dinner parties for colleagues from different faculties, encouraging discussion and the exchange of ideas across the departments. His sociable nature was put to good use when he became Director of Development in 1988, fundraising with Dennis Howell MP for cancer research in Birmingham, with Lady Howard de Walden for research into Parkinson's disease, and with the Duke of Devonshire when fundraising for the blind, a cause close to his heart as he had lifelong affliction with poor eyesight. So Peter Jarrett became chairman of the Birmingham National Institute of Conductive Education, a member of the Birmingham Lunar Society, a governor of the Royal National College for the Blind, and a governor of the Shakespeare Institute. I don't know how he found time. He also took great pleasure in his fellowship at the Athenaeum Club. In the 1990s, he re-engaged in industry after turning to the early and developing field of risk management and information and cyber security. This is way back in 1990s, can you believe? Peter helped to develop expert systems to undertake security assessments and produce effective countermeasures to threats to businesses. In retirement, Professor Peter Jarrett remained active in teaching and the development of students, including as an external examiner at a university in Singapore. At home, he provided free mathematics tuition, tutoring those from low-income backgrounds, and his students became lifelong friends. His final recognition in research came in 2013 when, along with former colleagues from the University Biology Department, he won the Lloyd Science of Risk Prize in relation to a mathematical analysis of environmental chemicals with potential to disrupt the body's hormonal system, known as endocrine disruptors, which were suspected of causing a rise in cancer. Lots of interesting information in this article. So Peter was a fellow of the Institute of Mathematics and its applications, a fellow of the British Computer Society, and a fellow of the Royal Statistical Society. So Professor Peter Jarrett, who died last year, would often quote the motto of the University of Birmingham, per ardua ad alta, which means by effort to high things, to illustrate the need for continued striving for excellence. He was a scholar, a teacher, a raconteur, an optimist who was resilient in the face of setbacks, worked hard, never gave up, and pursued excellence in all he did. So that's a fantastic article. You might never have heard of him, but I'm sure you remember him now. Professor Peter Jarrett, who died aged 90 last year, polymath and pioneer of early computers.
Dave, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, no.
The place we lived when we were young, faith in miracles. Our thoughts trade constantly and without boundary. The ringing of the division bell had begun. Along the long road, on down the causeway, do they still meet there by the cut? There was a ragged band that followed in our footsteps, running before time took our dreams away. Small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay. The grass was greener, the light was brighter. Glowing behind us, to a glimpse of how green it was on the other side. Steps taken forwards, but sleepwalking back again, dragged by the force of some inner tide.
What a great track that. High Hopes by Pink Floyd back in 1994. Oh, only 30 years ago then. And we played that because we were talking about polymath and pioneer of early computers, Professor Peter Jarrett. He died last year, aged 90. He was at the forefront of the development of the field of computer science and the introduction and use of computers in university teaching and industry. What an amazing guy. And his motto was, he often quoted the motto of the University of Birmingham, Per Ardua, Ad Alta, which is Latin for by effort to high things. Hence we played High Hopes by Pink Floyd, all good stuff. If you wonder what on earth you listen to, it is the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 till 12. This next article is from the Times as well. It's by a chap called Paul Simons. He does a column called Weather Eye, and I must say, it's always a fascinating read, and I could not resist this one because it's all about public lidos. Again, if you're old enough to remember what they are, due to the hot weather, I think that's why he's written about this, and I thought this was very apt. So he says, of all the ideas about how to cope with the hot weather, One suggestion has received little attention. Perhaps we should build more Lidos as they did in the 1920s and 1930s. So somebody wrote into the Times recently. The first outdoor swimming pool was opened as long ago as 1815 in Bath. But the golden age of Lidos was in the 1920s and 1930s when there were more than 300 public Lidos in the UK. This was an age when sunlight was promoted to banish the horror of rickets in Victorian times, when lack of sunlight in dark and smoggy cities led to chronic lack of vitamin D, causing deformed bone growth and disability. Sunlight also became popular for helping to prevent and treat other diseases, especially tuberculosis or TB, and mounting clinics open for patients to sunbathe in the open air under the intense ultraviolet rays of sunshine at altitude. In 1924, the Sunlight League was founded in Britain by Dr. Khalib Salibe to promote public health with clean air and sunshine used as heliotherapy, described as nature's disinfectant, stimulant and tonic. Dr. Khalib Salibe also campaigned for new Lidos to help to promote public health in sunshine. By the 1930s, 169 Lidos had been built in Britain. But during the 1970s, many Lidos fell into disrepair and closed as sunny foreign holidays became more affordable and offered guaranteed warm sunshine. At the same time, local authorities were backing new indoor leisure centres that were no longer victims of the unpredictable British weather. Now we seem to have come full circle with a revival of public Lidos proving popular to help cool off in the increasingly hot climate, as well as promoting exercise. But sunshine is a double-edged sword capable of causing sunburn and skin cancer. As leading surgeon Sir Henry Govin wrote in an article in the Times in 1922, this is brilliant, 1922 somebody wrote this, sunlight is the greatest of all natural tonics. But like a good champagne, it invigorates and stimulates. Indulged in excess, it intoxicates and poisons. So that's all about the resurgence of public Lidos.
Lido missed the boat that day. He left the shack. But that was all.
One more job out again.
little bit of Lido shuffle there by Boskaz, because we're talking about the resurgence of public Lidos, where, you know, it's a place where you can go and bathe or dip your feet in. Very popular years ago. Of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital, if in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 till 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, you are loud and clear, thank goodness. We always worry, you never know, it is live show.
No, I shall I'll carry on at this pace, hopefully.
So, Paul, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, I guess it's started out with a lot of the things that are sort of a bit difficult about science, because it's not always accepted that things are scientific are correct. So I like listening to the piece you did about Peter Jarrett.
Oh, yeah, what a guy, eh?
Yeah, and my days sort of in electronics back in the 70s. Then they were talking then about things like the paperless office. The great thing about computing coming in was that we wouldn't be having sheaves of paper and filing cabinets anymore. It would all be paperless in an office. And it seems to have taken quite a while for it not to have actually
Yeah, exactly,
that.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult. And things like climate change. I think listening today about Donald Trump blaming Canada for air pollution because of their wildfires, and he thinks that a suitable way to cure that may be to put trade tariffs on Canada, which kind of is a different way of thinking, isn't it?
Indeed.
So, sort of looking at that and a lot of the changes, the news that potentially the incoming Prime Minister in the UK is going to allow drilling again back in the North Sea, which is, again, one of Donald Trump's sticks that he's been trying to beat the country with for a while, that we should drill, baby, drill, is his sort of great sort of line. So, sort of looking at that and thinking about what's going on, I thought I'd have a look and see what our local universities are doing, and Sheffield University are investing in the future of aerospace production. So there's a landmark R&D facility which they say will boost the UK aircraft manufacturing. So it's a major R&D facility, and it's going to look at manufacturing capabilities to accelerate production times and using advanced materials to make aircraft lighter. And that facility is officially now opened in South Yorkshire. And at the University of Sheffield Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, the AMRC, has opened this new facility, which is set to give the next generation aerospace manufacturing capabilities. They say that the pioneering research and development facility will give the UK next generation aerospace manufacturing capabilities. And it's led by the University of Sheffield AMRC, and it's a facility that's home to Boeing's biggest global research program, with the potential to create 3,000 UK jobs and around £2 billion annually in export opportunities. So the facility, which they dubbed the Composites at Speed and Scale, or COMPASS, will unlock the advanced capabilities required to manufacture large-scale plane components faster and more efficiently within the UK, using composites rather than metals, and Boeing will draw on the facility to automate production of composite parts for its future aircraft programs. It's a £54 million facility, and it's in the heart of South Yorkshire's investment zone, and it's a major step forward, they say, to growing the UK economy. And a nice line-up with Oliver Coppard, the local mayor, and they're sort of celebrating this launch. So for aerospace, the advanced materials will enable this production of lighter aircraft parts that then will give improved fuel efficiency and reduce carbon emissions, they say. So Compass has Boeing as its first user, and it's home to a global aviation leaders global research program. So it's pretty good news for South Yorkshire. It says that this is based on the prediction that global aircraft demand is going to hit record highs, with more than 40,000 aircraft needed over the next 20 years. So this industry in the UK is being targeted to play and capture a greater share of that multi-billion pound aerospace export market.
Oh, export, interesting. Pity we haven't got an airport anymore then, Paul, because the Advanced Manufacturing Park is not that far away from where Sheffield Airport was.
No, well, I think, but again, you know, I mean, the problems are changing. If you look at what's coming out of the sort of a reassessment of our defence needs, there's a very imminent danger of us phasing out the sort of classic naval fleet that we have, and that's to move in favour of basically a base ship where they control drones from it. So rather than have a big battleship with guns blazing and everything else, they're looking at light, fast, stealthy craft that can do lots of jobs, and they're sort of changing that, and that's kind of based on lessons learned in the war in Ukraine. And they say currently that the drone capability in the Ukraine is costing something like 7,000 Russian soldiers' lives a week, which is horrific if you think about it. But it underlines the developments that are happening. And you can see that the industry within the Ukraine has developed to take these new technologies forward and diversify and make more specialised items. So it's quite a world that we're kind of moving into of change. So I guess having a research facility locally is very good news.
And it is a technically in Rotherham, I believe, but it's just off Sheffield Parkway, so if you're local, you may know it's there, you may not.
It really is sort of an interesting sort of move forward. I think that Sheffield University again has been involved with I'm just fiddling about with the computer as usual.
Oh, yeah, you can't blame the cat then, Paul.
No, he's out and about because he's enjoying a bit of cool.
We're just saying we've become acclimatised now. We're quite cold, Paul.
Yeah. The other thing from Sheffield University is actually a new spin-out company. And it's working on developing the next wave of display technology. So it's a next generation screen technology, so that it's capable of making smartwatches, PCs and other consumer electronic displays more affordable and durable. And it's being pioneered by the university spin-out company, which is called Pixel Flow. They currently raised over £5.25 million in funding to drive this development of what they're calling revolutionary micro LED manufacturing technology. And I think if you're an aficionado of hi-fi and things like that, you'll probably come across micro LED in the new generation of TV sets that are starting to come about.
It's interesting because we were talking about Professor Peter Jarrett way back in the 70s, just at the start of all this, and it just keeps going on, doesn't it, and on.
Well, that's the amazing thing. I think it parallels it well. So the micro LEDs are going to be used in the next generation of displays for consumer products like smartwatches, car dashboard displays, because cars are going in that direction, TVs and PC monitors with superior brightness and energy efficiency. So again, it is sort of improving performance, but also increasing efficiency. The current production methods, they say, are comparatively expensive and slow, and they think that this pixel flows technology could manufacture micro LED displays at industrial scale, making them much faster and significantly cheaper to produce. So it's a spin out from the university, as I said, and they've developed an entirely new mass transfer process. So we talked about an approach from the university into developing a better way to build housing under a canopy system. We had guests in studio to talk about that. Well, this is actually a new development and taking the technology to industrial scale manufacturing. So funding's been led by Northern Gritstone. That's an investment company dedicated to supporting ambitious science and technology businesses in the north of England. Hurrah!
Brilliant. You know, we do talk about a lot on the Science Show about, you know, universities, Oxford, Cambridge, and indeed brilliantly Sheffield as well, having these startup companies that start within the universities, and they're the ones that take all that science and research and translate it into real life differences, don't they? And you see it, we're seeing that more and more, aren't we? That joining of this is the theory. We've worked this out, but what will it give us in the real world? Is it marketable? Is it commercial?
Well, I think there's a great example earlier on in the week where they talked about the Ebola outbreak, which is increasingly getting to be a serious problem for Africa. And they said that using the same technology that was used to develop the vaccine for COVID, they've modified that now to address the Ebola virus. And so they have drastically taken down development time for a vaccine, which is on the borderline of going into human testing and distribution.
Yeah, but incredibly fast. So, you know, we talk about bad things happening. You talked about Ukraine and them using drones, and that's not a great thing, is it? But what it will come, something good will come out of that in the end.
Well, I think it's a reality check. You know, we saw drones, various forms, and what you've got to do is compare. And you know, we've talked about things in the past, like lasers. You know, when lasers came out in a lot of the sort of industrial and scientific areas, people were saying, well, yeah, it's a nice kind of idea, but what are we going to do with it? Well, you know, it's fairly ubiquitous these days in lots of sort of commercial applications, lots of domestic applications. It's really sort of taken over in things like communications. So recently I got a fibre update on my broadband. And what are you doing? You're using a laser to pulse down a reflective glass cable rather than copper. You know, these things do sort of come about. And quite often, again, in the past we've talked on programmes about things that are rediscovered. I think when we talked about stealth aircraft, we were sort of looking at that and thinking, oh gosh, this is like science fiction. But in actual fact, there was a scientific paper published many years before, and that was the basis for some new research, which ended up by developing stealth capability for aircraft. and was actually a piece of Russian research that was left dusty on the shelf for many years, and it was picked up by American scientists who said, "Oh right, okay, that yeah, I can see an application for that," and they kind of reduced the apparent radar image of an aircraft from being something pretty big to something the size of a tennis ball or less.
Wow.
So it's that the stealth aircraft can kind of hide within what looks like a flock of starlings or something.
Yeah.
You know, that's an amazing redevelopment of technology. And quite often they've looked at things like Greek fire was a thing where in the days when galleys were rowed by lots of oarsmen, sometimes slaves, and the navies of the day suddenly came up against a weapon which flung ceramic pots of a pitch-type material through the air, and when it landed on the ship, it spread fire massively and very quickly. So it's amazing the kind of moves that we've got taking forward, I think, and very interesting, I think, as well.
Yeah, so, because we still talk about COVID now because it's sort of like 6 years since, but that because of the way they had to develop that COVID vaccine, the collaboration, the speed at which they did that was unprecedented, wasn't it? It'd been unheard of. It would take 5 years or 10 years maybe to get something through like that. So now they're already something good has come out of COVID because they're trying to tackle Ebola on a much faster scale, aren't they? Because they've already used that.
They found a toolkit
to
develop new things.
Yeah. So,
but anyway, one of the things that caught my eye as well this week was new in India, of the development of a unicorn. So, what does that mean? Yeah, no, it's not the white pony with the sort of corkscrew horn on the front. It's what you call a new company that's taken itself beyond a £1 billion valuation.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, so a unicorn company is one that's worth more than £1 billion. And the company in question in India is Skyroot Aerospace, and they've recently become India's first space tech unicorn, reaching $1.1 billion of valuation. And they've launched the Vikram 1 from the Indian Space Research Organization's launch facility in southern India. It's a seven-story lift rocket, which took off at 12:05 Indian time and travelled 280 miles to reach low Earth orbit in a 16-minute flight. So it's the first Indian private company to launch a rocket into orbit, which makes India only the third country after the US and China with a private company capable of orbital launches. So India's put a lot behind developing things, but this private company's taken them a step further forward. And historically, this rocket was named after Vikram Sarabhai, who was called the father of India's space program. It's small and it's got the capacity to carry payloads up to 350 kilograms. Their co-founder and chief executive, Pawan Kumar Chandana, told the BBC before the launch that access to space remains a major bottleneck, with satellite operators often waiting for months and even years for a launch, and this is India's chance to grab that kind of business. So it says that Skyroot aims to cut long waits for satellite launches by offering dedicated missions for small payloads. So instead of sharing space on large rockets that fly on fixed schedules, customers can book a launch that's tailored to their satellite and its required orbit, which is pretty much like they say, calling a taxi instead of waiting for the train.
I think it's a bit more expensive than that, Paul.
Certainly that, but again, it's one of those things. I think companies have been looking at low payload launch vehicles, even in the UK, We did try the Virgin system, which failed and has really disappeared out of the race. But this again is a straightforward launch rocket that can take a payload into space. And it's a kind of guideline for India, who now say they want to travel out into space with further missions launched from now until about 2040, they've got a thing. So Skyroot came into being in 2018, and that's when two founders who were colleagues with the Space Research Organization in India. And in 2020, they opened the space sector to private firms, which allowed them to create this unicorn business. So that's the Saturday's launch came at a time when Indian space programs been to focus on historic moon, Mars and solar missions in recent years. So we've heard about Vikram orbiters, I think, for the moon. So it's very interesting that they've managed to do that. So where we're a little bit more earthbound with developing airlines for the future, this is India developing spacecraft.
But it's an expensive business, Paul, isn't it? When you're talking about space.
It is, but I think it's one of those things, you know. Unfortunately, for a lot of countries, you're going to be damned if you do and damned if you don't. I think that actually having the capability, again, one of the things that was in the news this week was they found another distant planet which has got an atmosphere which potentially could make it a livable planet, and they're saying they're getting more and more of them. I think that the particular planet that they've been able to sample the atmosphere of, and they say it's substantially helium, so it's not particularly going to support life.
No.
But I think that, you know, a lot of people are looking to that sort of where you go. So, and I think you can sort of follow the path of the doomsayers who say we're on a sort of crash to nowhere. Or you can look at the people who say, well, you know, we're going to have to spread out eventually, so let's develop the technology and the capability to be able to do that. So it's as always with science, I think a lot of the time there's a sort of scientific knowledge acquisition. It's exciting, but then it's what you do with that and how you apply that to the world. So currently it would be interesting to see what we can do to compensate for the increased heat that we're suffering from.
Well, we're not in the minute, Paul. We've had to put our fleeces on to cycling, but we're not complaining.
Oh, no,
we're
no.
not complaining. Well, but brilliant, yeah. Paul. We're going to have to let you go now because you've chosen a brilliant track. It's not your first choice, but we got there in the end.
No, it's great. You can fly away with it because it's Lenny Kravitz.
It's Lenny. Excellent. It. And on the final note, Paul, will we ever get a paperless office? Will we?
I doubt it, but, you know, we can always hope.
You never know. Bye-bye, Paul. We'll speak Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Thank you, Paul.
Cheers. Bye-bye, bye. Paul. Bye.
Bye.
I wish that I could fly into the sky.